So this is about what happens when you reach St. James's Palace on party night. As they approached the palace's lofty red brick gatehouse, the sedan chairman carrying Henrietta and Molly in Princess Caroline's wake had to force a passage through a raucous, torch-lit crowd. Hundreds of people had gathered expectantly to catch a glimpse of the blazing beauties arriving in their jewels. Now, Molly LaPelle, along with her friend Mary Bellenden, another maid of honour, received the loudest sigh of admiration. Although they were not yet 20, these two were the toast of their generation, and each was as lively and pretty as the other. The arrival of the matchless Mary and Molly elicited the kind of greedy, semi-salacious gasp that still runs up and down red carpets today when the stars appear. Through the palace gatehouse lay the Great Court, where soldiers kept guard. It was also called the Whalebone Court, after the whale's skeleton, 20 feet long, that was clamped to one wall. Here, a sea of servants and stationary sedan chairs jostled to drop people off before the fine columned portico sheltering the entrance to the royal apartments. The palace authorities complained constantly about all this traffic blocking the courtyards and passages. Emerging gingerly from their chairs, Mary and Molly and their colleagues were now faced with a wide and grand staircase. Here, the scarlet-clad yeomen of the guard acted as security staff and bouncers, refusing entry to the humbly or unsuitably dressed. There was no official protocol involving invitations. To gain admission, you simply had to look the part. So it was vital to swagger and to pretend to be mightily acquainted and accustomed at court. One would-be gatecrasher, an enterprising young law student, was turned away at the bottom of the stairs. He went to a nearby coffee house for half an hour. He returned refreshed and discovered that a shilling pressed into the guard's hand was the key to getting through. The ladies of Princess Caroline's household were much more readily admitted. They pushed upwards and onwards, taking the tiny, geisha-like steps permitted by their hoops, their gait giving the impression of wheeled motion. They glided through the first floor guard room, then the adjoining presence and privy chambers. Their destination was the large new drawing room, built by Queen Anne, overlooking the park and hung with beautiful old tapestries. This was the great drawing room where, four nights a week, the nobility, the ministers, etc., were accustomed to meet, and where all strangers above the inferior rank may see the king. Here at last is the Georgian court en masse. There is scarcely room to breathe. The air is excessive hot, and the crush has prevented many of the nobility even from entering. Chairs are completely absent from the room so that nobody can make the mistake of sitting down in the royal presence. The courtiers' colours are pale and sparkling. The penniless poet John Gay, hopeful of a royal patron, arrays himself in silver and blue as he asks himself how much money will do. Knights of the Garter wear blue sashes. Senior courtiers, staffs of office are white. The court's young bloods sport pale blue silk coats, while their older colleagues have blue noses, pale faces, gauze heads, and toupees. A glittering gown is spotted with great roses, not unlike large silver soup plates. And the silver is relieved with touches of crimson, a red sash for a knight of the bath, a gentleman in a prodigiously effeminate rose-coloured waistcoat, and the stout Princess Caroline in pink, superior to her waiting nymphs as lobster to attendant shrimps. Princess Caroline, Prince George Augustus and their party become the centre of attention immediately upon entering. All the most ambitious young courtiers behaved dutifully to the king when he was present, but preferred to pay their court to the younger, bolder, more promising heir to the throne. Peter Wentworth, a junior official, observed that on drawing room nights, many people were backward in speaking to the king, though they are ready enough to speak to the prince. While the king's party had the greater power, the prince's had the greater glamour. The younger courtiers now fought to fawn over Prince George Augustus, and drawing room behaviour was often surprisingly ugly. In the crush, people would jostle and squeeze by one another, shouting pardon over their shoulders. It was simply impossible to hold a conversation. Everyone laughed when Lord Onslow tumbled backward among all the crowd and lay sprawling, while another gentleman, who was drunk and saucy, had to be ejected for throwing a punch. In his sector of the drawing room, George Augustus spoke one by one to those courtiers desperately trying to catch his attention. He turned his backside to those he did not wish to acknowledge, a technique known as a rumping. The rumped or spurned could console themselves with having earned membership at the exclusive Rump Steak Club. This was boorish behaviour, and Prince George Augustus was not the handsome, charming prince of a fairy tale. His peppery personality and the fire of his temper appeared in every look and gesture. He would let off steam rather comically by kicking his hat and sometimes even his wig around the room. A sufferer of high blood pressure, he was subject to constant palpitations around the region of the heart, especially after dinner. This prince then had passion. He made an excellent soldier when his courtiers' concerns for his safety allowed him to take the field. At the decisive European Battle of Oudenarde in 1708, he led a celebrated cavalry charge against the enemy and had his horse shot under him. Military trivia remained his greatest interest. In the drawing room on this particular evening, he faced a challenge that demanded rather more subtlety than a cavalry charge, though it was equally daunting for him to face. He was about to have to be polite to the father he loathed.